You know, you can come a bit closer. I do bathe every day, brush my teeth. Come closer to the power. It also means the people in the back can come in. Very good. And it also gives you a chance to move. I often used to say, and I told this to people in Penang, sometimes when they come in, instead of actually getting up and walking and sitting down, they just move their butts. And so when they actually just move their butts and they fidget around, that's where they polish the wooden floors. So if you go to these really ancient temples with wooden floors, whether it's in Sri Lanka or Japan or somewhere, or Thailand, you see that that's how they polish the floors. They just get you guys to come a bit closer, please, or a bit back. Sit for a long time, just fidget around. And then you polish the floors at the same time. It's very efficient. Anyway, so for the talk this evening, once everyone is sitting down, there's a couple of things I'm going to talk about. There's one thing I remembered I did promise I would talk about. There's a little bit which is interesting. It does let people know about, you know, how, you know, this Dhamma of Buddhism actually works, and how it can make difficult problems and actually have solutions. And that was, somebody told me, I did actually see this in a newspaper. There was one person was born recently from a frozen embryo, which had been an embryo conceived 24 years ago. I think it was 24 years. And they froze the embryo, and now they managed to implant it or something, and now it is actually viable. It's being born. It's a nice baby. So, how old is that baby? Does that mean that it's only a little baby, and as soon as it can actually drink, it can go to the pub? Because it's 24 years of age when it's born. Does that mean when it's only about 12, it can drive a car? Does that mean? And of course not. So they say, well, now, where has that being been for 24 years? Was there a stream of consciousness? Now, many people think about the idea of a soul or a self. I was just telling people over in Singapore, because they always wanted to take these selfies with me. And I said, come on, we don't agree with selfies in Buddhism. We call it weefies. Not me, not I, not a self, but weefies. So we have all this new language which we're trying to introduce. Like, you know, when you say that you're going to kill two birds with one stone, that's not very Buddhist or compassionate. So we change it to cut two carrots with the same knife. Whatever it is, we try and change the usage of our words to be a little bit more compassionate and kind. But in the case of an embryo which was in a womb for, no, it was actually frozen for 24 years, then, no, was it like a stream of consciousness in that embryo to begin with? And there was no debate about that years ago, and I decided just to look and see what the theory says, what the Buddha actually said, and then, you know, just work from that. And so what the actual Buddha said is actually when consciousness first appears in the mother's womb, then from that time is considered to be a human being. Not just from the time of conception, mother and her father coming together, but when actually consciousness first appears in that. And then to consciousness to first appear, you do need a neural system. You need a first part of the brain being formed, which means that it can manifest, it can appear. And of course, I don't know why the Buddha said that when in the old days, unless you had psychic powers, you couldn't really see what was going on inside the mum's tummy. But obviously these days with ultrasounds and other great equipment can actually see inside what's going on, then we can actually know that sometimes you see that little being reacting to pain. or reacting to pleasure. That sometimes the people show me ultrasounds where the baby is obviously is laughing or is smiling anyway. And certainly I know this because, you know, one of these cases, there was a woman who would, you know, her husband worked in Dubai, and she would actually come over to Australia, you know, she was Australian, every Christmas, New Year time, on holiday, visit her family. And so she came once, and she was pregnant. And so I did some chanting for her, and she said, yes, and also I'm going to take lots of your Dhamma talks, so that, you know, when I'm just waiting for the baby to be born, I will listen to those Dhamma talks, and just, put me in a good mood. Nothing else I could do. And so, the next year she came to see me at Bodhinyana Monastery with the new baby. And as soon as she brought the baby into the room, the baby was just, you know, half asleep. And as soon as I started talking, the baby looked up. And she recognized me. I've heard this voice before. Because it was obvious she recognized me, because that was actually, she recognized me from the womb. This little girl who was born had heard my voice so often when her mother was playing it. She actually remembered who I was. So there is a time. So, you know, sometimes it's very, very hard getting new jokes. But that was obviously a case that the baby was learn how to appreciate my incredible, amazing jokes. Just like I hope I didn't say this 2 weeks ago, but about the person. Oh no, it's actually just Australia. I'm just looking at the Australian economy. What does Australia produce that no other country in the world produces? You know the answer to that? Australians. You're allowed to laugh. Come on, a baby can laugh at that. Why can't you? So anyway, going back to the baby in the womb, it responds, you know, to pleasure, to pain, and you can actually see that on an ultrasound. So that is where life begins, according to Buddhism. And it also, it just, you know, answers the question, just how, in your morality, how could you feel that, you know, you experience a little embryo or an egg in a petri dish and that gets destroyed? It doesn't actually, looking through that whole process, doesn't really appear to be sort of hurting or harming. But sometimes you see like a fully grown or almost fully grown sort of embryo, fetus, in the mother's womb, and that actually looks so much like a human being. When it hurts, when it has pleasure, you can identify that seems to have manifesting conscious awareness. And so that is from where the life begins. So what happens there? It can be frozen in that to have 24 years, 50 years, I don't know how many years, but of course that's not considered to be life yet. Until it is actually appears to be conscious. And that comes back to some basic ethics which, you know, you heard. It's so simple that what the Buddha said to his son was just basic precepts, basic morality, basic ethics. If it hurts somebody else or it hurts yourself, then that is, you know, bad karma, unethical, lack of virtue. Or like, is it harming, is it hurting, or is it helping others and yourself? And I remember so many years ago, there's a class of kids came into Old Centre in Magnolia Street, years and years ago, that was 33 years ago, and they wanted me to teach them something about Buddhism. I hadn't really got much experience of teaching kids, you know, even teaching grown-ups was hard enough in those days, but they said, teach them something. And so I said, well, no, what is, you know, anything which harms another or harms yourself, you know, is bad. So what harms others? And so straight away they say bullying, hurting, you know, saying bad speech, stealing. And what about other things? What harms yourself? Oh, you know, sometimes when mum and dad argues, you know, one of the things they said there was really, really hit me. I mean, it happens, but they said, and sometimes when mum and dad argue and get separated, and they live in different houses, and they say, well, you know, isn't a single parent family good enough? He said, no, said this little kid. I'll never forget what he said. He said, because when I get upset at my mummy, I haven't got a daddy to make up to. Because I need two people. I need a spare to love me in my house, not just one. And I thought it was just so cute coming from a little kid, how they feel. But anyway, the general goodness and the kindness, and I've got all the precepts from them. What about drinking alcohol, I asked the, or taking drugs? And the kids say, well, just, you know, my daddy's just really not nice if he gets drunk. And little things like that from kids, you can actually feel just what is good and kind is, you know, you can see it very easily. So this is actually where we use now answers very deep questions in an easy way. And that brings me on, not just where life starts, but where life ends as well. Because we have this problem I keep being asked, yeah, but, you know, we know when from this you can see basically where a person begins their life, but what about when they end their life? What if they're on a ventilator? What if they are unconscious, in a coma? Are they alive or are they dead? What should we do? And many times that has happened. And as many times people say, well, look, if you see me in a vegetative state, just, you know, on life support, just, you know, on a liquid diet, please pull the plug. So there was one Australian guy, he was watching the cricket on TV for hours, and he was on a liquid diet, drinking beer all day, with like a vegetable, no quality of life, so his wife pulled the plug. That's not quite what they meant. But sometimes when a person is sort of in the hospital and that's your job, you know, somebody asks you, you know, should I turn off the life support or should I keep it going on? What should I do? And the answer often is, you know, is actually just that, is there a manifestation of consciousness there? Can it appear? And obviously a doctor sometimes just shines a light into the eye or speaks in their ear, but sometimes it needs something a little bit deeper than that. So a lot of times that, you know, if that is your mother, your father, you know, a loved one there in the hospital, often, you know, you just sit by them, hold their hand, and just ask if there's anyone there. There's a Vietnamese family here. They're not here today, but they often support us. And their father, grandfather, he had a bypass operation. And every now and again, most people survive the bypass operations, but every now and again someone doesn't make it. And this fellow, he was on the edge of life and death for days. And I know I did this. I went to the ICU about 3 or 4 times a day. How I managed to do that, I still can't understand because it's such a long way. But I really supported him. And why I went there was, you know, that I would go there and do some chanting, some uplift for him. And then you could actually feel his energies, you know, getting more strong. And then, you know, his life indicators got a bit stronger. Then I go back to the monastery and then it would go down again. The family had asked me to come back again. It was just, and I really thought he had a chance. This is not psychic powers. All it really is being sensitive, using your meditation to feel another person. You know, not just their body, but, you know, their mental activities. I mean, you can feel when a person's angry. You can feel when somebody likes you. You know, and you may not even know them, but you can actually, people do have a resonance mind to mind. You don't need to know it totally, you just feel that, you know, where they're at. And you can trust that because it's always, you know, means that I've been able to actually help out in these situations. And he was almost surviving, then he was going down again for about 3 or 4 days, And they asked me, you know, he's getting really sick again, can I go into the hospital again? It was in actually Royal Perth Hospital in the ICU there. And I went in there again, and I sat next to him, and it was totally different. There was nothing left. He'd gone. The stream of consciousness had vanished. The consciousness no longer manifested there. And you could actually tell that. And you could feel the difference there. For so many times I've been going there, chanting, meditating, trying to give him a boost of my energy. And in the end, what happened? He'd gone, he died. It felt so different, easy to pick up. And I told the family, said, he's gone. And I still remember just the doctor and the nurse, and nurses are so skilled in the ICU. They were looking at me and going, because I don't know how they knew, but they sort of saw something there that it was finished, it was over. But that's actually how consciousness can manifest. And for those of you who are very, very knowledgeable in Buddhist theory, they always say that one of the worst things you can ever do, the worst karma, is killing your mother or father. And that makes many sort of people very, very on edge. You know, should I ask the doctor to pull the switch, or what should I do? And there was some of you who've been around here a long time. I remember this because I just came from Singapore. I gave a talk last night, and Angie Monksfield was there. And her auntie would tell the story when she was in a coma. She was in a coma. She never told me exactly why she was in that coma, but really, really deep in a coma. And obviously she came out of it, but her story of how she came out the first time was fascinating, like a first-hand description of what it's like and what happens. And she said she was in such a dark, dark, dark place of blackness. And what brought her out was like sound. She thought it was a tinkling of a temple bell. And now that is so much the case with our understanding of the nature of the mind in Buddhism. It is the bells which wake you up in the morning. You alarm. You try and throw a bucket of water over your kid to get him to go to school in the morning on time. That doesn't work. But the bells, the sounds does. And even in meditation, deep meditation, it's a sound which can pierce the deep meditations, not the other senses. So that makes so much sense that she came out because she heard a sound, and there was a very appealing sound, an enticing sound, which brings you out of this deep, deep, deep hole which you're in the emotional, physical, as emotional, mental world. And then when she came out of the coma, she could hear everything, she could see everything, she could feel, but she couldn't tell anybody else that she was there. It was just like a one-way channel where she could receive information, but she couldn't give out any information. She couldn't talk, she couldn't move any part of her body or even blink her eyelids. It was just, but she could hear and see everything. And what was terrifying for her at that stage was that the doctor had a family meeting by the bedside where the specialist said, your mother is not to any possibility of recovery, that she's going to die, so can we please have your permission to pull the plug and turn off the life support? And she could hear all of this. And she couldn't say, I'm still here. Don't kill me. And because it was a Chinese family in Singapore, the brothers, they had to make the decision, and the brothers just wouldn't make the decision. That's your mother's life, in the balance. So it was the eldest son. It was his responsibility. It's a Chinese culture. Eldest son had to make the decision. And he was arguing, don't leave that for me to decide. Too much responsibility. And he said, that's what you have to do. Pass him the buck. And that she told me this drama going on by her bedside, where she was trying to speak, trying to even will her son. Son, don't kill me. I'm still here. And the son was just hesitating. on the edge of saying, pull the plug or keep her going. And then he said, keep her going for another 24 hours. Thank you, Sasha. She thought, but she couldn't say anything. It took another 24 hours for her to start to wiggle a toe. And to the doctor to realize that actually she was recovering. And she made a full recovery. She told everything about it. And to this day, they say, well, what should we do? Because even the doctor at that particular time, and maybe the medicine has got much better these days and more opportunity to find out if there's any activity there at all. But in that particular case, you know, I would say, well, you know, why don't you stand by your mum's bedside or you hold her hand, feel her, is there anything left in there? And you know, if that is someone, your mother, your father, someone you've been so close to, of course you know, it's just basic intuition, basic feelings. Follow that sort of intuition, take away the fear and you will know. And that's the same thing which happens with the pets. You take a pet to the vet, and you say to the vet, eventually tells you, "Oh, we've got to put your darling dog down." And you know, sometimes people just feel that you can't do that. Even that person many years ago who took the dog into the vet and said, "Look, the dog, you know, please help it." And the dog took a look at the, sorry, the, not the dog took a look at the vet. The vet took a look at the dog and said, there's nothing you can do. The dog is dead. And this is like a variation of, if any of you like Monty Python or the Dead Parrots sketch, remember that one? But this is much better than that. So they took, the dog is dead. They said, it's not dead. Because, you know, you're in denial when it's somebody you really love. Do something. And so the vet said, okay, I'll give it a try. So he opened up another cage and took out a cat. And he put the cat nose to nose with the dog. And the cat... and the dog didn't move. And then he took it, you know, around the back of the dog, lifted up the dog's tail... and put the cat right next to the dog's, you know, what's underneath the tail there. And the dog didn't move. Turned the dog on the belly, and the cat was on the belly scratching it, and the dog never moved. And they told the owner of the dog, said, look, the dog's dead. Yeah, I think actually, because my dog never loved cats at all. He hated cats, you know, would chase them. And so he hated cats, so... that must be the case that he's dead. Thank you very much. So then the vet gave the bill. $2,020. $2,020! What's that for? It's a $20 for the consultation and the $2,000 for the CAT scan. Ho, 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 ho. So anyway, real dogs, this was good old Judy, some of you know Judy here, this is, you know, this is, many, many people have done this, you know, she took her dog to the vet, only a tiny little dog, and but cancer, you know what happens, and so took the dog, had cancer and just spent so much money, as you would do, you know, dog, the cat is part of the family. And so I took it to the vet, and then the vet said, no, it's got to die. You know, you've got to euthanize it. There's no hope, it's in pain. And she followed my teachings, my advice. She said, can I have a few minutes with my little cat? And so, yeah, come in. And she took the cat, you know, into a little corner of the vet, have some privacy. And she held her dog, sorry, so they held the dog in her arms, looked in its eyes and said, you know, are you ready to go yet? Have you had enough or do you want to carry on? And looking in her eyes, you know, she got the response pretty quickly. And the response was, no, the dog did not want to be euthanized. It was the dog's call. It wasn't your job to kill the dog or put it out of its misery. Because as you all know, if you see an animal suffering, No, sometimes you put it out of your own misery, because you can't stand to actually see it like that. But, you know, what does a cat, what does a dog think about it? And they do have feelings, they do have conscious awareness, and you can pick up on that. If that is the dog, the cat you've been with for such a long time, you can feel it. And Judy said, no, I'm taking it home. And she said the vet was so upset at her. You're a Buddhist and you're so uncompassionate. You know, you don't care about the... You know, we talk about, you know, not killing things. And that cat, so that dog is suffering. You've got to euthanize it. There's no hope. It's suffering. It's got cancer. You can't do this, you stupid, unkind Buddhist. Or something like that. But, you know, it was her right, so she took the dog home. And it was about 6 months later, she took the dog to the vet again. It had made a full recovery. And the vet couldn't believe it. He examined the dog and said, you Buddhists are so wise and compassionate. And many people have actually done that since. It is, you know, is their consciousness there? Is it their will? It's up to them what they want to do, rather than us to say. So that was just saying something a little bit about how to stop, or how to solve some of the ethical problems of our world. Instead of having like the dogmas, what Dharma teaches you is not what to do, but how to find out for yourself, how to learn, how to discover. Because you know, you can feel what's right, you can feel what is wrong. And that gives you a guide of what to do in your life. Because what I did promise I was going to talk about this evening, that was only supposed to be for 2 minutes, was about the uncertainties and the chaos of life. A new year is going to be starting soon. What's it going to be like for you? And do you need some encouragement, protection to make sure that next year is a really good year for you? What should you do? And some people, instead of actually relishing and celebrating uncertainty, we always want to try and beat the odds to fix the system in our favor. So first of all, some of you may be looking at horoscopes for the future. And I never believe in horoscopes or astrology. The thing which stopped me believing in astrology and horoscopes was quite a few years ago. There's one of our Australian members who wanted to give me something for my birthday. What do you give a monk for their birthday? It's almost impossible to find something for them. Don't think I'll get you some tea bags. I've got so many tea bags. What else does a monk like? Nothing much. So anyway, this guy was very innovative. So he found out, he knew my birthday and the year of my birth. He found out the time of my birth, roughly. I think he asked it and I was just, didn't really think much of it. But then when it was my birthday, he said, Ajahn Brahm, for your birthday present, I have commissioned your horoscope from a very well-known astrologer. Cost me a lot of money, but that's worth it to present this to you for your birthday present. And he read it out in public. He said, Ajahn Brahm, for anyone who's born, for the person who's born on the 7th of August 1951, about that time, that because of the alignment of the planets and the stars and other stuff, that this year, the astrologer predicted, for me, would be a very, very good year for romance. That's what my horoscope said. It never works. I'm still a monk. And that's when I lost my faith in horoscopes and astrology. But, you know, that's, you know, people crave for certainty when there's a bit of chaos in this world. Or just like that story of Ajahn Chah, when they said, You're a monk. I'm sure that you can predict the future. Come on, predict the future. And so this man came up to him and said, read the lines on the palm of my hand, he said. And I said, we don't do that. You know, that's not the sort of stuff which, you know, great monks or teachers or nuns do. We actually teach the Dharma. And just said, you mean you won't do it? And I just said, no. And then the person was prepared. He was very sneaky. And he said, he tried to outwit Ajahn Chah. Don't ever try and do that. But he tried. He said, you remember the last sermon you gave on gratitude? Now, I have been giving donations to this temple for such a long time. I bring food to the temple. I serve on the committee. I look after, come on, busy bees. I help out, erect the tents on, what time is it? Saturday. Saturday at 7 o'clock. I do all this work for you. And this is the first time I've ever asked anything from you, Ajahn Chah. And you say no? What type of gratitude is that? He put him on the spot. So Ajahn Chah, you've got a point there, you know, gratitude. You know, you were really generous, so I suppose I should help you back. Give me your hand. So Ajahn Chah, the one and only time, he read the lines on the person's palm to predict his future. And he said, you know, because I'm a monk and I keep my precepts, what I tell you will be the truth. He said, yeah, I know. That's why I asked you. So Ajahn Chah, are you ready for this? He said, yes, yes, yes. Are you sure? Yes. So he started tracing the lines on his palm very slowly. And every now and again, he would stop and he'd look. And sometimes he would smile. Sometimes he'd shake his head. This poor man was getting so excited and afraid at the same time. This was his future being read, and it would be absolutely true, whatever Ajahn Chah said, no matter what came out, he knew he could trust this monk. And it took forever to finish reading the palms on this man's hand. And as soon as Ajahn Chah was finished, yes, 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 what's my future going to be? Yes, please, tell me. I know you just read the palm. What I say is going to be absolutely true. Yeah, I know that. What is it going to be? He was so excited. Oh, he's so excited. But Ajahn Chah was very calm. And it seemed that it was forever before he would get the prediction for his future. And eventually, Ajahn Chah said, your future, said, yes, yes, yes. Your future, yes, is going to be, yes, uncertain. And Ajahn Chah wasn't wrong. Because the future is not set in stone. We make the future. Your future is work in progress. You can interfere with, well, it's not really destiny. If it was destiny, you couldn't interfere with it. You can tweak it this way, you can move it this way. The future is open to you. That's what the law of karma means. The karma you're doing in the present moment is more important than the karma you've done in the past. It's what you make out of what you've got. You can change everything. It's so easy if you realize it can be done. To give you an example, I told this story again last night, but it's amazing. That's in Singapore. This was one of the stories in the Good, Bad, Who Knows book. But they obviously hadn't bought it because they all laughed when they got the final. And it's actually quite an important, deep story I may not tell you yet until I finish the story, but it was this monastery in the north of India about this time of the year. Actually, probably about in November time. And the old abbot, you know, had passed away, and they had a new abbot. The old abbot was working too hard and got worn out and faded away. So they had to elect this new abbot. And then you are, but if you're like a head monk, you're supposed to be wise and a good meditator and a good leader, but you're also supposed to have a few, you know, little powers in the back pocket just in case. And one of these powers which this abbot had in this monastery in the north of India, he would always be able to sort of, you know, predict, you know, sort of catastrophes or whatever's happening. In particular, at that time of the year, the other monks depended on him. And they did this year as well. They asked the abbot, is it going to be a cold winter up in the foothills of the Himalayas? Or is it going to be a mild winter? What's going to happen? The old abbot would always be very accurate. He would be able to meditate and see very cold winter, mild winter, or in between. So they asked the new abbot, and the new abbot said, well, leave it with me tonight, I'll meditate on it. But the new guy wasn't really as experienced as the old one. So instead of meditating on it, he got out his cell phone and rang the meteorological office. Asked to get through to the head guy. It was actually a professor. And he didn't tell he was the abbot of a monastery, a famous monastery. All he did, he said, if you don't mind me asking, what's the long-term weather forecast in this area of North India? And the professor said, well, you know, it'd probably be, you know, average cold. Thank you. And so the following morning, the abbot, after the chanting, told all the monks, I predict it's going to be just an average cold winter up here. So you better collect some wood to heat the monastery. So all the monks, every other duty was stopped and they went to collect some wood. And after 1 week of hard work collecting wood, they asked, is this enough? And the abbot said, leave it with me. I'll meditate tonight. He wasn't lying. He did meditate, but he also rang up afterwards. He rang up the meteorological office and said, how's it looking? And the professor said, actually, it's got worse. I think it's going to be quite a cold winter. Thank you. So the following morning, he told all the monks, get back to work. Go and collect some more wood. It's going to be a cold winter up here. So they all worked really hard getting some wood. And then after another week, same thing. Is this enough? Leave it with me. In the night when all the monks were asleep, he got the cell phone out and rang the professor anonymously. How's it looking? Oh, it's got much worse. It's going to be a really cold winter. Thank you. So, next morning, those monks, it's going to be really cold, said the monk, the head monk. Collect more wood. So they really worked hard, collecting wood all over the place, stacking it here, stacking it there. And they were really exhausted. At the end of the 3 weeks, is it enough? Leave it with me. And that night he rang the professor again. How's it going? And the professor said, I've never seen anything like this. The signs are it's going to be one of the coldest, bitterest winters ever seen in this part of North India. And the abbot, anonymous, the professor didn't know who he was, said, are you sure? He said, yes. How do you know? Well, said the professor of meteorology, all those monks in that holy monastery are collecting wood like nobody's business. That's how I know. So that was sent to me some years ago as an explanation on how Wall Street works. On the prices of stock. Is it going to be a bear market or a bull market? Just find out what the monks are investing in. We don't invest in anything except good karma. So anyway, that is why people want to predict the future, but they just mess up. They just follow stupid signs. So instead, we have this beautiful embracing the adventure of 2018. What's it going to be like? Do you want predictions for the future? I will give you a prediction for the future. 2018 is going to be uncertain. Of course it is. But when those uncertainties come up in life, number one, we expect them. We expect things not to go according to plan. It never goes according to plan. And number two, we realize that, you know, with kindness, with wisdom, with peace, we can make use of whatever happens in our life. It's not the cold or the heat or the economy or whatever happens. It is always how we relate, how we deal with these things. Yeah, you get divorced. Yeah, you find another partner. Yeah, you die. Yeah, you get born. Here we go again. You lose your job. You get another job. You become a monk. You disrobe. You become a nun. I'm not the same person, but... It's so uncertain, life. But what that uncertainty does, it gives you these wonderful opportunities. One of the things I was talking about when I was over in Penang and Singapore is there's all these people I gave a talk on, countering cancer. And just why it is that sometimes people, they're diagnosed, and sometimes, I don't know if I told you this, but I've been recently diagnosed with a contagious disease. And I should let people know, I don't have really allowed the committee to actually to know this. I've got a contagious disease. It's called Hepatitis B. You come too close to me, you might catch me. Hepatitis Buddhism or something. Hepatitis 1, whichever you wish to call it. You might be called it Hepatitis AB. Hepatitis HM1. Yeah, okay, whatever. But anyway, all this fella went to the doctor, and the doctor said, it's got really, really worse, your cancer. How long have I got to live? And he said, 10. Oh, in 10 months, 10 weeks, 10 days. And the doctor continued, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. Now that's terminal. But so I don't want to give false hope, but I've seen so many people, when they think they're going to die, and of course they do die. All the uncertainty of life, they close off, this is going to kill me, and it does. But the uncertainty of life, even the doctors, a really good doctor will never actually say, it could be that no one is ever sure. Exactly, no one is ever sure. So, who knows what's going to happen? Because the uncertainty is there, you have got the leeway, you've got the wiggle room, you've got the opportunity to maybe to nudge it in another way. It's not certain. Not for sure. That means it gives you hope. And if you have that hope and you leverage on that hope, you focus on that, you usually get through. Have you ever seen that people in really difficult situations, it's just the attitude towards it makes them succeed or go under. So that's what uncertainty does. It gives you options. Nothing is fixed. So you don't need to be afraid. It's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. Who knows? Sometimes it's just the experts just looking at the monks to see what we're doing. Are we collecting more firewood? How are we building our huts? Just for those of you who've ever been to Bodhidharma Monastery, and if you've been there while I've been away, that I think I'm the only monk whose bedroom is a tourist attraction. I live in a cave, and many people go up there and look at the cave. And sometimes, when I'm tired, I finish the meal, and I've got to kick people out of the cave. Like, I want to live in that. Yes, yeah, it's interesting to see a monk living in a cave, but it's not a tourist attraction. So, and many of you have seen the cave where I live. But when we first built that, it was underground, had a big concrete on top, and lots of earth on top. A lot of people got a bit worried. They say, Ajahn Brahm, do you know something we don't know about a nuclear attack coming to Perth? Why have you built a bunker like that? It even got to the point that sometimes even visiting people in hospital, they know I'm very busy and just go overseas and just lots of things on my plate. So if I go and see someone in a hospital, they say, Ajahn Brahm, why are you coming to see me? Is there something the doctor hasn't told me? Sometimes they get worried. So anyway, especially that I was actually told this when I first came here, that especially in Thailand, in Thai tradition, when I was a young monk, you'd only go and see somebody if they were really sick. So, you know, because I didn't know that, you went to see a nice person who was just, you know, just a good friend, a good support, and you'd go and see them in hospital, and say, come on, what are you here for? I only came up here for just a keyhole surgery. What's going on? Or just like that person, who, they did have keyhole surgery. When they woke up, they were complaining of a headache. A really bad one, migraine. And the poor old nurse, you know, thought there was just an exaggeration or just hypochondria. He said, no, look, give me something for my headache. He said, well, it's only keyhole surgery, you know, to your stomach. Have you ever got up there at all? He said, well, it really hurts. So they had a look, and sure enough, there was a swelling and really red on his head. So he rang up the surgeon. Some complications here. What's going on? Never seen this before. You know, it's only keyhole surgery, but he's complaining of a huge headache, and there's a swelling up there. Is there some infection going up there? What's happened? And the surgeon, you know, said, well, you know, there's been many, many cuts to the health budget, so that when we ran out of anaesthetic, we had to use the traditional method. Anyway, I don't think they've done that, maybe yet, who knows, anyway. But anyway, the uncertainty of life, you always give like hope and sometimes it happens. So even in like tennis or soccer or cricket, I don't know, it's always, you don't know what's going to happen next. That's what makes a sport interesting. If you knew what was going to happen, in apparently somebody said there was the latest episode of Star Wars, yeah. So, has anyone seen that yet? What happened in the end? Do you want to tell people? Of course you don't want to know what happens in it. That makes it so, you know, not really worthwhile reading, does it? But I still remember, I forget which monk it was. There was one monk, he was due to, you know, ordain as a monk. But he said, no, not now, can I sort of put off my ordination as a novice? Can I put off my ordination as a novice for another 6 months? He said, why? We've got a space now. You know, you're ready. He said, well, you know, the last episode of Harry Potter hasn't come out yet. I'll see that first when I become a monk. They've got strange priorities. But anyway, they want to find out what happens in the end. But you can understand, if you knew what was going to happen in the end of your life, you could read the book of your life and find out who did it, or, you know, what's going to happen in the end. Would that certainty make life any better? In fact, number one, you know, it would just make life really boring. Number two, it would be just total, you know, my word, gomayang. You know, if you don't know that word yet, it's a Pali word. Go means ball, mayang means shit. You know, you don't know what's going to happen in the end. Your future is work in progress. So that's one of the reasons why it doesn't matter what you feel. Oh, just the last little story and then I finish off. Just how uncertain life is. And how life can just turn and twist in unexpected directions any time. And that was the story, one of my wonderful little stories. I should put it in a book somewhere. But it was of this criminal, this career felon in Los Angeles. He ran away from home. And I remember him writing the article at an incredible age. I don't know how this could have happened. 4 years of age. He had a very abusive family and he ran away at 4 years of age and he survived. You know, he survived, but he was always going into sort of like petty crime, hanging out with really bad people, you know, getting adopted but running away again, going to institutions but escaping. And he was in another sentence, coming to the end of his sentence. You know, being a gangster for a long time. He's about 40 or 50. And they had a caseworker for him, a social worker, to try and help him that at the end of this sentence, maybe he could actually, you know, find something and not go back to jail again. But, you know, what skill has a career criminal who's been in and out of jail since he was basically four? But his caseworker had a friend of a friend. This was in Los Angeles, L.A. A friend and a friend who was making a movie. He was, at the time, the director, whatever, was unknown. And they wanted to make a movie which was authentic. And this caseworker, social worker, said, well, look, I've just got the guy for you. Can you give him a job as a consultant on the movie? Because this fellow has lived all his life with criminals and gangsters. You know, he can be like the expert on gangsterism. And he was just coming out at the right time, so the director gave him a job as a consultant on the script. How real gangsters speak. Apparently no gangster ever says, make my day, punk. That is just Hollywood. But they got the real gangster speak, and this guy was so good at it, the director actually gave him a part in the movie. And the director, it was his breakthrough movie, Quentin Tarantino, Reservoir Dogs. And that apparently was Mr. Pinky or something. Of course, I've never seen the film. Mr. Black it was. Mr. Black, okay. And he was the only one, apparently, who really stood out as an authentic star of the movie. He was real. So he managed to use all his skill set, which was very unique. And he said he married the case officer, and he was living in Malibu with a big mansion with more money than he could ever imagine. And he said he couldn't understand just pinching himself. What happened? You know, so many years, you know, in jail, a no-hoper, and just within 1 year, there he was, his life had all just totally changed out. That is just the way that life is so uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen next, which is an incredible, beautiful thing to keep in mind. Use the chaos of life. People are afraid of uncertainty. For me, uncertainty gives you opportunities, new ways of doing things, new possibilities. Everything is open. So, but when you're afraid, you think, ooh, it's going to happen again. What you look for is what you get. What you don't look for, sometimes. So if you look for opportunity, look for possibilities, you'll find them. That is how we actually learn how to make use of this opportunity called life. So, that's the message for 2018. Are you sure about that? Will you make it that far? Who knows? But anyway, I wish you all the blessings for the coming year. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, so where those three sadhus come from, you give energy and a boost to stuff. And that's actually traditional. I think I told us this, I think, in a monastery. I went to visit this very, very great monk called Ajahn Singtom in Thailand, and he would just be very exuberant, very popular, great monk. Okay, we have some questions here from Christine from Malta, Pam from Scotland, and Tanya from Spain, all from Europe. How can you ask questions over there? It's supposed to be freezing cold. Are you asking how much wood to collect in your house for next year? When the consciousness leaves the body after death, does it something anywhere in this world? Does it travel elsewhere? How does it come back into a new being? Okay, that's a nice weird story. It's stream of consciousness. this was a story which I don't mind telling you. It was the Nibbuto. He told a story because he was from the Punjab in the north of India, northeast of India. That's warm down there, so they don't need to collect any wood. But he said that in his village, it was Punjab, the mostly Sikh religion, that all the men have the surname Singh, all of the women have the surname Kaur. That was just tradition. So because they all have the same surname, all have the same men and women, there's going to be more opportunities that they have the same first name as well. So it's much more common, people with the same name. So what happened? This old lady in the village passed away in the morning. She died. Checked her out, she was dead. And they arranged the cremation for her. These do it in the same day. Get the funeral pyre, get everybody, all the relations, get the priest in to do the job. But that afternoon, she came to again. To everybody's surprise and shock, she opened her eyes, she wasn't dead. And she came back with this wonderful story. I thought it was this really amazing story. She said that when she died, a stream of consciousness left her body, and that there was two spirits grabbed hold of her and took her to this big spirit, the boss spirit, the president of the spirit world or whatever it is. So anyway, the president, how can I get POTUS out of this? President of the underworld spirits. POTUS. Okay, some people got that one. Anyway, and this head guy took one look at that girl and the two spirits and said, "You stupid spirits! You made a mistake! That's the wrong person! Take her back!" So they had to take her back. And that's when they took her back into her body, and that's when she woke up in the afternoon. They just got the wrong person. And a few minutes later, another woman with exactly the same name passed away, died. So the moral of that story is, please, it's not identity fraud, but identity mistakes. People with the same name, they've got the wrong person. Apparently that's happened in the police. Apparently they've arrested people that got the same name, and it's not really the right person. So please remember, don't have a bit of a strange name, not like anybody else, otherwise that might happen to you. You might die and get the wrong person. Mistakes happen in life. Anyway, so it comes back again, sort of when you want to. From Scotland, do you think it's possible that people can be contacted using Ouija board after they have died? You don't need to use a Ouija board. If they're ready to be contacted, they'll come and tell you. I mean, it's great when people tell all these really amazing stories. This one person just told me that, this was in Penang, that her mother passed away. And when they dreamed of her, that she was this 18 or 19-year-old girl. The dress which she used to like to dress up when she was a young girl. But really radiant, very happy. And he said, but I thought that, if she was going to go to a heaven realm and come back and see us, she'd come back so we can recognize them like an old woman. I said, of course not. If you're going to go die and you can, take a mind-made body, what mind-made body would you like to have? Just like you've seen photographs of me when you're just fit and strong and slim. So if you've got a choice, which one would you like to have? So she chose a nice sort of young woman. So that's, instead of possible that people can be contacted using Ouija board after they've died, if it's somebody really close to you, then a lot of time you dream of them at night time, because that's when your guard is down. And if you try to contact them, you usually block them. But, sometimes that if they're very close to you, sometimes you can see them. Even, they love this little story over in Singapore and Penang, because they always are really scared of ghosts but they always like hearing stories of ghosts. And that was once over in, I was in Calcutta Cemetery. There was a Chinese funeral. And so those of you who know Calcutta Cemetery, that you start at the gate and we go in procession leading the cortege. In this case, it was a burial. And a Chinese burial site is the furthest away from the entrance. And I knew, been there many times, about 10 or 15 minutes walk. So I knew I had 10 minutes to kill. That's the wrong word at a funeral. But, you know, I knew it's just, 10 minutes walk. So we were just, the funeral director, she was an elderly woman. And I said, how long have you been in this industry? And she said, for 20, 30 years. I said, oh, great. Just to pass the time until we get to the gravesite. Have you got any ghost stories? I said, oh, yeah, heaps. I said, really? Tell me some. He said, well, look, they're so calm. Which one do you really want? Because when she works in the office at the funeral parlor, I won't tell you which funeral directors it is, but when she works in the funeral parlor, sometimes she's doing the paperwork in her office, and somebody walks past the office door, and it's one of the dead people. But she's so used to that, what she says when she sees one of the ghosts of the people who are supposed to be in the coffin, she said, she scolds them. She said, get back in your box. She said that was so funny. The way she treats them. Get back in your box. Scold them. Oh, okay, she's caught me. Sometimes if people are sensitive, they can see them. From Spain, how can you forgive yourself after aborting your child with multiple dysfunction and disease? How you forgive yourself? No one else can forgive you. But somebody like myself to say, what was your intention at the time? You know, why were you doing that? And all the time it would be out of compassion and kindness. It's the only thing you can do. You're between a rock and a hard place. And in Buddhism it's very, very clear, it is your intention is paramount. Why you do it. If it is out of, you know, what you think is compassion, because it's never one person. Sometimes we look at just the person, the being growing in your womb. And sometimes that it's not just them, it's you, it's the family, the hospital, there's so many people involved. It's the same as when a person is about to die and just turning off the life support for them. And now one thing which, you know, to make this really real, when Ajahn Chah had a stroke and was incapacitated, he couldn't speak or couldn't actually give any instructions, the monks met together. The monks at Wat Pho Phong. Ajahn Chah and I were here at the time in Magnolia Street. And they had a meeting, what should we do? And even the monks, all the monks in that very good monastery said, no, do not try and keep him alive. No life support, just let nature take its course. He's given enough teachings already. And it was only the intervention of His Majesty the King of Thailand, who said, no, I want to keep him alive, that they kept him alive for another 9 years. But even the monks wanted to actually to pull the plug. Interesting on their teacher. So it's the intention. Why are you doing that? Where's it coming from? If it's coming from a noble motive of like compassion, kindness, letting go, then that's always good karma. And this was really important. This one was from Spain, because when I was in the East Coast, I can't really say where, there was one Sri Lankan doctor in that particular state. She was one of only two people who were authorized by the government to perform late-term abortions. And many people who knew her job really criticized her, saying, you're a murderer, you're breaking precepts. But this was only in extreme cases, like people who had, you know, been raped, women who had been raped, or with beings, fetuses, which were very, very unlikely to survive, or maybe even cause problems for the mother, may even threaten her life. This was extreme cases. And they had ethics boards would actually decide those cases, but she had to be the one who did the termination. And, you know, because, you know, when it was explained to me exactly what goes on and why they do it, I said, look, you are doing that out of compassion and kindness. It's not out of any ill will. So I said that, you know, you should not call people like that murderers. They're doing a very difficult job in very difficult situations. So forgive yourself. You shouldn't even need to have asked that question, because in this world, that why do you have to ask men to forgive you or take the lead from that? Sometimes all the people who make those decisions, all the religious leaders, the ethicists, most of those are men. And what do they know what it's like to have a being growing in your tummy? They don't understand what it's like being a mother and the difficult decisions they have to make. The guy can even walk away, but that mother, that's her baby, that's her child, will always be. So because of that, first of all, the ethics of abortion should be decided by women, not by male leaders. Basically, we don't know what we're talking about. You can empathize so far, but you can't go any further than that as men. So what we can do, just religious leaders, people who show compassion, just to give as much support as possible, to say to the woman who is considering an abortion, sort of, you know, these are what you can consider, but whichever decision you make, I will never ever criticize whichever way you go. My job is not to make the decision more hard. My job is to stand by you, give you compassion, give you kindness, whichever you choose. Because I've come across too many women who have been traumatized by guilt. And quite frankly, if I could try and put myself in that position as much as I could, you can understand this is nothing to be guilty about. You don't do these things lightly. So, basically, from Spain, I support you. So, in this particular case, your child with multiple dysfunctions and diseases, if I was you, I'd have probably done the same thing. And I say that as, you know, quite a well-known monk. So, you have my forgiveness. You have my, not, I don't even need to forgive you, because I don't think you've done anything wrong. I can understand and give you compassion. So please put it behind you and forgive yourself. You don't even need forgiveness. People have done much, much worse things than that. So you are forgiven. Okay, sorry for talking long on that, because I come across that and just, it's so unfair the way that people put guilt on mothers who have such a difficult decision, without really knowing what they're talking about. So anyway, thank you about that. Any questions from here before we finish off? Yeah. Quick one over there.
Oops. Thank you for tonight, Ajahn Brahm. It's always wonderful. I love your meditations and laugh at your stories. Thank you. I've got a lovely story that I'd like to share too, about uncertainty and opportunity. There was this, it's a true story about a young girl who had Asperger's, which is a form of autism, had a terrible time at school, left very early, hated it, difficult parents, so she left home very early, was on drugs for 5 years, drugs and alcohol to cope, and homeless. And anyway, she was apparently a lovely mover, and one day she was just sort of stretching and just pre-dancing in the park, and she was noticed by a lady who was actually a dance teacher. She had a school, and she said, could you please come and join us? You're so good, and we'll pay you. So she sort of agreed to that. And so from the money that she earned from the dancing, she used to go to the zoo and sit with the gorillas and just stay there. And she just sort of for 2 hours at a time. And the staff actually noticed this after quite a while, and they came up to her and they offered her a job. They said, please come and, you know, please, because you love the, you know, we love you, with the gorillas and please come and join us and help the animals and the gorillas. So she did that. And anyway, after a while, they said, please, why don't you go to school and, you know, develop the skills with the animals? And so she said, no, I can't. I hated it. But anyway, she eventually went and she got in and she studied and she got into zoology and she studied. Yeah. Anyway, she got through, she got a master's and she became a professor.
Oh.
And she actually became the world's leading authority on gorillas. And that's a true story. She's now at our WA, at our Perth Zoo.
Yeah,
so I just think that's such a lovely story that I like people to yeah. know. Yeah. Thank you.
Everybody has their place in this world. No one is ever rejected if they can find that lovely place. So amazing she could do that.
But I think animals are so wonderful. They just give people so much peace and especially
yeah.
autism, you know, they're just amazing.
Yeah, but I must just add to that, there was this... in a village in northeast Thailand where I was there for 9 years. There was a girl there who, I don't know exactly what happened to her, but she couldn't speak, she could only grunt. But she fitted into the village, she was welcome, she was part of everything. Any sort of festival she'd always come to, and the other girls would also take her. Whatever, she wasn't excluded at all, she was part of everything. And I thought, what a wonderful thing inclusion is. And she taught me it was one of the most wonderful gifts I've ever seen given. It just makes me emotional when I remember this story, because I was cleaning up the hall in this monastery in Thailand. And I was just behind a big cupboard when this girl just came in. And she was looking around. I thought she was stealing anything. She wouldn't steal anything. She was making sure that no one saw her, but I saw her. And she had this little lotus flower she'd folded. And she put on the shrine. And she did a little bow and she ran away. Because you could understand that when I saw that lotus, and it wasn't the most artistic or, you know, skillful origami. And she just put it in there because she was afraid if someone saw it, they wouldn't let her put it in there. And as soon as I saw that, I told the other monks in the evening, I said, where that came from, that's one of the most wonderful gifts I've ever seen. I know how hard it was for her to do that. But if anyone touches this, I will deal with you. You leave that on there. Not the most beautiful as far as, you know, appearances, but when you know where it came from, it's gorgeous. And those are the sort of acts of kindness and generosity. It's just not so how much or how beautiful, how elaborate it is, but where it comes from. So great, that lady there just... amazing, she became a professor of zoology. So many people are like that in this world, and they're inspiring what you can do. Anyway, thanks for that, great.
It's hope for all of us.
Yeah, one day my jokes will improve. Okay.
I'd like to thank you for a beautiful talk this evening, Ajahn Brahm. You're always very, very inspirational. This actually aligns with what I want to talk about, aligns a little bit with what the lady was talking about before, about animals.
Yeah.
Since becoming a Buddhist, it's changed my life a lot. It's made me very aware of my external surroundings. But even more importantly, it's made me very, very aware of what happens internally as well.
Yeah.
And as I was learning more and more about the Buddhist teachings and the Buddhist loving kindness and understanding and compassion, this came up against my practices of eating meat.
Yeah.
And I found that every time I ingested meat, I would start feeling physically very, very sick.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could actually feel the ingestion of the suffering of the animals, and so I could no longer do that. I was just wondering, because I want to evolve as a human being, as all of us do, whether ingesting all that suffering, because animals in the factory farms have a terrible time, they suffer all their lives and they die in the most terrible ways. I was just wondering whether that actually, as a Buddhist, gets in the way of enlightenment in some way.
Yes, it's very good to be as compassionate, as kind as you could possibly can be. And even like animals in zoos, sometimes you can look at it as the animals are in cages, or sometimes some of those animals in a zoo can be like almost like a monk in a monastery. You've got all these rules around you, all these bars which you cannot transgress, but sometimes there's a sense of freedom in there as well. Ideas of freedom. But anyway, there's a lot of learning and growing. But again, one of the nice things about Buddhism, it's not one size fits all. Sometimes that again, a woman does commit an abortion. Sometimes a person eats meat. Sometimes, you know, we put an animal in a difficult situation. But, you know, that we have a lot of problems like that with, I mentioned I think last time that we had some mice in our kitchen. And since I thought it was actually quite amusing, that we put some Buddhist mouse traps in. They don't kill them, but one of the mice was so fat it couldn't fit in the mouse trap. And I said, that's typical of Bodhinyana Monastery. Even the mice are fat. Okay, so it's getting late now, so let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami.